I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge from WNIJ. And if this is your first time hearing our show, I've got great news for you. This is based on a really simple idea. We've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of this show with us, so please do tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations and your story ideas at teachersloungenIU.edu. And on our show today is Matthew Oakes. He's an English professor at Rock Valley College, and he's also leading the school's RVC Votes program, where they're trying to encourage students to register to vote, answer questions, help them learn how to research what's on their ballot and what their voting rights are. Pretty timely, considering we've got a presidential election coming up here in, I don't know, a few days now. We talk with Matthew about that and a community history project he's working on with his students, along with diving into his teaching philosophy, which he sees as education as a tool for liberation. Again, we talk about all of that and so much more, but first, we have an education story we want to share, and well, since we're already here at Rock Valley College, we might as well stick around. Illinois is devoting more and more money to vocational education for programs like truck driving and auto collision repair, and at Rock Valley College, students can receive training and get a job in just a few weeks, and do it all for free. Brian De La Rosa started fixing up cars in high school. He took an automotive class at Jefferson High School in Rockford, where he just graduated. And before graduation, he found a flyer at school for Rock Valley College's collision repair course, which, instead of a full 4 years of college, takes just 16 weeks.
That's what I was also looking for because, I mean, 4 years going to college is a little long.
More than halfway into the program, De La Rosa's already started an apprenticeship at an auto body shop in Belvedere, and once the class is done, he's staying on to work there.
They have actually already, spoke to me about it. They're like, oh, would you like to stay after the program?
And as good as all of that sounds, one of the biggest reasons De La Rosa chose Rock Valley is because this course was, well, free. He received a grant covering his tuition through the college's Trade Review and Career Exploration, or TRACE, program. For the past 2 years, with funding from the Illinois Community College Board, Rock Valley's given out hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of these grants, and they're designed to help the community meet workforce needs through targeted, typically short-term training in auto collision repair, forklifting, truck driving, and massage therapy. Ryan Russell helps recruit students and run TRACE at Rock Valley.
Every single program that we have, we're paying the complete tuition. Some programs are getting stipends. Our all-body collision repair guys, for the first 8 weeks, you're going to get $200 a week as long as you show up every day. They have the opportunity to make $1,600 just by showing up.
He says these trades are in high demand, and normally this training would cost a lot of money.
Massage therapy, $11,000. Auto body collision repair, $5,500. Truck driver training, $5,000. Forklifting, $700. Who has $11,000 just to fork out of their pocket on a random whim? And if you're not, what are you doing? You're taking out loans?
It's even harder for many students because some technical training programs aren't eligible for federal financial aid. The program primarily serves students from 16 to 24 years old, with many, like De La Rosa, coming straight out of high school. But that's not always the case, though. Delaney Ostrowski is a massage therapy student, and she already has a bachelor's degree from NIU. She works at a physical therapy clinic, and her original goal was to go to grad school for PT, but decided against it, in part because it would have taken years and another $75,000.
Still a very scary number, but I did know that I wanted to help someone in some way.
Then a friend told her about RVC's massage therapy program. She could use her physical therapy knowledge and skills and take the classes while still balancing her three part-time jobs. She says it's very hands-on, which she loves, and again, wouldn't take 3 years to finish.
It's just so nice to accept that, hey, I'm in this role, and in a year, I'm going to be out there doing this to other people.
Training takes a year for massage therapy, but other courses are much shorter. 16 weeks for auto collision, and Russell says forklift training is way shorter.
Getting them in something for 3 days like forklifting, I have students that have made upwards of $23 to $25 an hour within a week.
Russell can't guarantee you a job when you're done, though.
That was something I learned in the beginning. I can't promise that you're going to show up to the interview, and I can't promise that you're not going to act ridiculous in the interview. But if I can promise at least an interview chance, I think that's a very good step in the right direction.
For younger high school students, they hold a summer event with local labor unions to introduce them to the trades and also earn a stipend for coming. Last year, 85 students received TRACE grants, 20 of which were those high schoolers, and he says interest is growing this year, and as the program continues, Russell's trying to build more community partnerships so students have more apprenticeship opportunities, and he also wants to make sure students have enough support while they're at Rock Valley, and that includes an advisor to help them find jobs, polish their resume, and build a sense of belonging at the college. He says applications are open year-round on Rock Valley's website. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Rock Valley College English professor Matthew Oakes. And we start off just talking about how the year's going for him so far.
It's been really busy. Last year I applied for a couple of things, some grants for some of the voting stuff, as well as the NEH grant. And it was all just theoretical, and then we won them, and now I'm like, oh, I have to do them.
And so it was one of those situations where you're like, all of these are going to be great, and that's future Matthew's problem.
Precisely.
But now all of those things
are actual problems
have happened now. So how do you juggle
problems.
All that?
I don't know. I just do. I don't have an explanation. You just figure out what something is going to get back put on the back burner, and everything else has to come forward. The voting stuff has really taken up a lot of time and energy because it's been so timely, but it's also been really rewarding. I've been working directly with some student leaders and doing classroom engagement stuff, and it's just people want to be talking about it, and so it's and there's a clear end point, thank goodness. So
well, knock on wood.
Yeah. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah, you've got the RVC Votes initiative going on. You gave me this nice sticker, which I am gonna put next to my I voted sticker. I wish in Illinois we had one of, have you seen like the one from Michigan where it's like a, they had like a student design contest
for
I voted stickers, and it's like a werewolf, and like the werewolf is like ripping off its shirt, but it says like I voted on there.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so, you know, not to critique, but like if we could get maybe a werewolf, maybe next time around.
Right. Have a werewolf.
I'd say that would be great. But this is, so can you talk a little bit more about RVC votes and kind of that work?
Sure. So in the past, Rock Valley has done different voter engagement work at different levels of, you know, campus-wide strategy. And oftentimes it's just been inviting the League of Women Voters in and asking them to help us register some voters, and then whatever classroom faculty do with their students. And there was a Department of Education Dear Colleague letter that came out last, I think it was January or February of last year, last winter. And it was for K-12 and higher ed, and it outlined what the federal requirements were for educational institutions in terms of what they need to do to help their students register to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also pointed us towards a number of best practices. And so we were able to use that as a launching pad, and we had a number of conversations with Dr. Spearman, who had a number of conversations with the Board of Trustees and the Cabinet, and they kind of gave us the green light to do something a little bit fuller and more strategic and more robust, and that hopefully we will be able to roll out, you know, every time, every semester, right? So it's not that we're just putting up this show for just this fall, but creating a different kind of civic engagement strategy and different expectation of what we're going to do on campus with our students to help them maintain their voter registration, to check their voter registration, learn how to research their ballot, what their rules are, what their rights are, and figure out how to do that well.
Have you had any common questions so far, or is it mainly just like, how do I know I'm registered? How do I get registered? Are those mainly the big questions that you get? Or
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that we have a lot of first-time voters. So a lot of the questions are just like, what do I do? I think one of my favorite questions was, it was actually a student in my class, and she said, okay, so I show up at a community center or a church, and like, what happens? And I thought it was such a great question. I was like, right, you don't even know what it looks like, right? You don't, I'm like, okay, well, there's going to be the table and there's going to be a line, you know, and I kind of just kind of painted the picture for her. So some of our students just need that level of familiarity in terms of what it actually is going
right,
to look
something
like.
Something that you might take for granted and like literally how does this process work
what
when I walk in the
like?
Door?
Yeah. And then a lot of our students too have misconceptions. Like a lot of our students, I hear a lot of students who are not enthusiastic about either of the presidential nominees.
Sure.
And so they'll say, well, I don't want to vote for him and I don't want to vote for her, so I'm just not going to vote. And I was like, well, you know, you can just skip that question, or you can do a write-in, or so there's just a lack of familiarity about what their options are. And so we've been highlighting a lot of state and local offices and a lot of state and local issues that we think are potentially things that students are going to want to be heard on so that they get out there and vote. And, you know, as I keep telling them, you don't have to vote for every single race. You don't have to answer every single question. If you don't want to vote for Trump and you don't want to vote for Harris, then don't. But then don't opt out and not vote on, say, the mental health referendum in Winnebago County. You know, like
right,
there
exactly.
are thing there are other things that maybe you do want to weigh in on, and you shouldn't feel not scared, but dissuaded from doing that just because you don't like this other option.
The thing I'm always reminding people in my life is that, you know, we actually do this a lot more than once every 4 years.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that's the other common, I don't know, it's not really a question, but we actually, in one of our, when we created the classroom presentation slides for our, we call them voting geniuses, and we have five students that we've trained who are going into
they
classrooms.
They are the voting geniuses?
They are the voting geniuses.
That's a great title. I gotta find my way to get one of those.
And so we created a presentation that they're all giving in the classroom, and one of the questions or one of the slide sets is about common myths. And that's one of them is like, do I have to vote for every person on the ballot? The other is that it doesn't matter who I vote for,
right.
that it doesn't affect me, you know, those kinds of questions. And we've tried to preemptively document why and how those things are misnomers or just not true, that mental health funding in Winnebago County, it does matter. If you want to continue, paying that 0.25% sales tax or not, right? That actually does impact you when you go to Target. When that really does come back to connect to your real life. So does funding at the state and federal level.
So you guys have RVC votes, and you also have the kind of all-in democracy. Is it challenge, I think, that you guys have gone on too? Or is that, do they kind of feed into each other and work
right.
together?
Yeah. So one of the great things about when we got the Dear Colleague letter from the Department of Education, they right. pointed us to this civic engagement action planning structure, which is part of the all-in plan. And once you create that action plan and submit it to them, it then opens up all these other organizations that are willing to help fund. So we've gotten free pizza for voter registration events. And so I call them the alphabet soup organization. So it's like All In, the Campus Democracy Challenge, Students Learn, Students Vote, Pizza to the Polls, National Students. There's so many of them.
Pizza to the Polls.
Pizza to Polls are my favorite.
Yeah.
And there's so many of them. And we just didn't even know they existed. But then once you kind of open up this door and you submit your action plan, you're sort of automatically eligible for all of these other things. So we've been able to apply for small grants. We've won a $5,000 grant and then another $2,500 grant. We've gotten two rounds of free pizza. You know, we got free t-shirts from MTV. They just start sending you stuff because all of these organizations have this really committed commitment to civic engagement and getting students registered to vote. So yes, there's all of these things and there's all these different wings, and I can't ever keep the alphabet soup names correct. But they're basically, it's all the action plan, and it's just who's giving us a little bit of money to do this other little thing.
There's nothing that has a higher approval rating for convincing people to come to an event than pizza. Like really,
right.
like I think it spans generations. It spans
yep.
nations. I think just in general, it's the best way to get us
yep.
to do anything.
We also have found success with donuts.
Right.
Donuts also work. So we did donut, forget to research your ballot.
Which wow, that's some real Pokemon go to the polls type of creativity we're looking for.
Yeah. But it's been fun because we've been giving out these stickers and these buttons. And actually just today, I was walking in the hall and I looked up and the student in front of me, she had her backpack on and she had a RVC Votes button on her backpack. And I had never seen this student before. And I was like, good. It's working, right? It's out there and it's something that we can talk about. And
and speaking of civics and civic engagement, like you're also leading some civic engagement research here too.
Yes.
Correct?
Yeah. So a colleague of mine, Professor Teresa Paulette Gilbert, she and I co-wrote a grant proposal to the National Endowment for the Humanities, where we are going to, the pitch that we made was that we're going to do an oral history archive of the Rockford Public Schools desegregation lawsuit from the 1990s, sometimes known as the People Who Care lawsuit. We just, Mrs. Gilbert, Professor Gilbert, was an individual who was around and involved in that process, and recognized that many of the individuals who were key individuals who both advocated for and against the desegregation suit are getting older, and some of them are starting to pass on, and we're losing this opportunity to capture a really important part of our local educational history, and not just educational history, but demographic history and driving the growth of the suburbs and the Rockford area. You know, there's all sorts of things that you can trace back to the desegregation lawsuit in the 1990s, and we don't want to miss out on the opportunity to catch those stories, to capture those stories. So we proposed this this archive, creation of an archive to the National Endowment for the Humanities, and part of it, an important part of it, is that our students are going to be helping us do the research and do the oral history archive and, collect ephemera and different things that we can find.
Has that process started yet?
We got the funding started in July. So we spent the summer just kind of getting ducks in a row and institutional research board approval and things like that. And then the RVC Votes project has taken the front seat. So once we get past November 5th, we'll be digging back into that. And the class that we're going to be using, the students that are in the class that are going to be doing the research, that's in the spring. So we're going to be using the rest of this semester to make sure that we're ready for that class to hit the ground running and to do that community-based civics research.
Right, more student involved, having students literally like in libraries at NIU digging through archives by hand and stuff.
Yep, so we wrote into the grant funding for travel to take students to NIU. NIU has the archive of the legal documents, so we'll be spending time there. We're going to be out in community sites, Rockford Public Library, NAACP, RPS has agreed they're willing to work with us as well. So our students are going to be out there doing this stuff. And, there are individuals who were part and parcel of the lawsuit. So we actually have a faculty member, her name's Suzanne Miller, and she was a named individual in the lawsuit because she was a high school student at the time of the desegregation lawsuit. So there's individuals it's one of those things that I'm not from this area, but once you start talking to people who are from this area, it doesn't take long to get, if you come around to the deseg lawsuit, that everybody had some kind of experience with it if they are of a certain age. And sometimes those are really positive, sometimes they're really negative. And we wrote into the proposal, we're not just talking to people who are advocating for the lawsuit. We're also really interested in talking to the individuals who organized and went to the state level to have the DSEG lawsuit lifted, or the DSEG order lifted. Those are important stories too. We want to make those available to our students and the community to know about and to research and to understand. And so then once we've started building the archive, the second piece next year is to work with our faculty colleagues in certain disciplines. We've already connected with like poli-sci, history, education, to think about how the archive that we build here at the library is something that they can pull on in their classes, so that even though their students may not be helping me on the ground level build the archive, their students are able to pull on the work that we did in their future studies.
Whoa.
So, and we talked with one of our education professors, Professor Flynn. She teaches a unit on the desegregation lawsuit.
Oh, really?
In her education class. She has an, I think it's an American Education History or American History of Education or something like that. And she was like, yes, I want it all. Whatever you have, like whatever you guys come up with, I will figure out a way to integrate it into my teaching material, which is great because she has, you know, she's literally teaching educators that are going to end up teaching in our area.
Right. Yeah.
And they'll be able to work with primary materials from individuals who had a firsthand experience of the deseg period.
Wow.
It's so pretty cool.
I mean, yeah, you guys are going to be digging through archives, documents, along with all of those like
oral
firsthand
history.
Interviews mm-hmm. and oral histories that you guys are going to be doing about it. Have you worked
Correct.
On a, have you worked on a project like this before?
No, I've done some training in my graduate studies on ethnographic work.
Yeah.
But this will be the biggest project.
It's exciting. It sounds like it's going to be a big lift too, but it's really cool that you have such a, you know, that students get to be such a big part of it too.
Right. And it's really nice to have the stamp of approval from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Like I noticed that as soon as I said, well, I have money and it's from the National Endowment for the Humanities, doors just start opening and people are much more willing to do the work because it's not just me going, hey, I want to do this thing. It's, you know, we've got that stamp of approval.
Right. Yeah, you know, I wanted to ask or talk a little bit too, and I was looking at like your bio that you have mm-hmm. on the website about being a teacher and kind of, you know, what that means to you and kind of along these similar lines that in that bio you talk a lot about, you know, teaching is something that you see as a revolutionary mm-hmm. act. And we've talked quite a bit on the show about teaching for social justice and kind of what that means to them. I'm curious, like when you think about, you know, your work and your teaching as a revolutionary act, kind of, A, like what that means to you and kind of like mm-hmm. what you feel like it manifests and looks like within your classroom, just like on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. I mean, I think about it in two ways. One is that I'm one of these individuals that just thinks there's no such thing as being neutral. You're either making the world a better place, you're either dismantling unequal, inequitable systems, or you're supporting them, either passively or aggressively,
right.
you know, whichever
status
way.
Status quo or
right.
not.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And there's either, you're either dismantling it or you're not. And that just is what it is. You're either teaching people to think about their own liberation or you're not. It's either, how is this helping an individual be a part of a community in a way that fuels their own freedom and the freedom of their family and their community and the collective community at large, or it's not. I think it's almost that simple. Like it's, you're either training to be a widget or you're not. You're either crafting a frame of mind that recognizes when they're being snowballed, when they're being manipulated, when information is being crafted in a way that's disingenuous, or you're not. And I think it is that, you know, you're creating those scientific literacies, numeracy, reading and writing literacy. You're either using those tools in order to help people help themselves and help the world become a better place, or you're not. And so I think that I don't always understand why more educators don't think of it that way. I don't see how it's difficult for me to wrap my brain around the other way to that more neutral, quasi-neutral perspective.
Right, because you hear people talk about how, you know, they'll say things, and I've even, you know, seen some pretty high-up education officials at the state and national level say things like, education is not political, or things like,
right.
or school is not political, which is, in my mind, kind of an absurd thing, because it's like mm-hmm. everyone is making decisions. Everyone is making
right.
choices. And those things, you know, have political effects at the end
right.
of the day. Even down to, you know, you're teaching, you know, writing classes and literature classes and the right. things that we deem as important knowledge in books worthy of the canon.
Right.
Does make a statement about what our society is and or what we want that to be also.
Right. I mean, when I think of the term politics as just the way we talk about how people engage in public life together. So
right.
as long as we are engaging in public life together, there is a dimension of that engagement that is political. Anytime I step outside of my door of my house, where inside it's just me and my family and it's just my family unit and my dogs, the minute I step out of the curb to pull the trash up from the curb because it was trash day yesterday, I'm now in public space. And that public space is inherently political because it's how we live our lives together in public. And there, and even if we don't want something to be political, oftentimes in education, it is made political against our will if we don't, if we're trying to keep it out. You know, when I did the commencement address two commencements ago, I used the example of Galileo. And the arguments around a heliocentric universe. And he was just telling the truth. And then the truth was made political, right? He was just giving the facts, and the facts were made political. And so, you know, he could say, well, just teach him what's true. And you're like, well, I did. And then they put him in under house arrest, you know? So it's sort of inescapable. And I think that, especially when we live in a democratic society, that we are already always making claims about what it, how we are meant to occupy public space together. Because education and democracy have always been connected with one another. And there are different schools of thought and different philosophical frameworks there. But I always like to think of what John Dewey said, which is, let me get this right. Democracy must be born anew in every generation, and education is its handmaiden, right? At the end of the day, democracy is a way of thinking about how we're going to conduct ourselves in public space as a community. And democracy says each individual has a voice that is valuable. And education is either leaning into that and supporting it, or it's not.
I think about community college, too, mm-hmm. and kind of the focus on really highlighting the community part of that.
Right.
Teaching people how to live in a community and help their community around them. And, you know, in that same commencement speech, I think near the end, it might even be the line that you end it with, is talking about, you graduates, you freed yourself, go back for the others.
Right.
And that last part really got me about go back for the others, because I was thinking about, oh, what does that look like? What is, especially mm-hmm. in the framework of education, going back for others. How do you think about that?
I mean, I think that oftentimes people ask me, like, how did I get into education? And I usually jokingly, but somewhat seriously answer that I just kept going to school, and eventually I stopped paying and they started paying me. Like, it just sort of, the checks just started going the other direction at some point.
It's a happy exit when that right, turns
yeah.
out.
Yeah. and I think that it was just that people who are lifelong learners are lifelong teachers, and lifelong teachers are lifelong students. And so I think there's just this reciprocity that that comes from turning around and being like, okay, I understand this, or I have these set of skills or this set of frameworks. How can I share that with other individuals? And there's a commitment to the field, but there's also a commitment to people and to sharing that knowledge. And sometimes I come up with these little quips for my students. And the one that I hit on last spring, which I thought was simply very simple, but hopefully a little bit profound, which I said to my students, everything that we know and everything we have in terms of like technology and development and advancements, everything we know and everything we have is because someone else figured out how to do that. And then they taught someone else how to keep doing it. So, like, it's the only reason that we are sitting here in this building and it doesn't fall down on top of us is because for generations and generations, engineers have been figuring stuff out and then teaching other people how to be engineers. And so I don't think about education as this, again, this other thing that we do. It's like fundamental to life, to having roofs that don't fall down on our heads when we're trying to have this conversation.
I think about it all the time, even from like
somewhat like ridiculous examples of how we've accumulated all the knowledge we've accumulated is just through like trial and error experimentation and then teaching the next generation, right? Like I even make the joke all the time about like you're walking through the woods and you see a bunch of plants, mushrooms and berries, and we can say that one's poisonous, that one's not poisonous, that one's not poisonous. Like we only know that because people have tried and learned and passed that knowledge on to generations, which is kind of,
Right, and you realize, and I think that when you think about that, like obviously it's funny, but it's also, it's really profound.
It's also like, it's just like literally true
and profound. And I think that there's something really remarkable when you think about, I think that there is this impulse that humans have to be like, hey, I figured out this thing. I'm going to go tell other people about the thing I just figured out. Like there's this immediate sense of responsibility, or even if it's just enthusiasm, but it's just I think there's this intrinsic connection between learning and knowing something and then the desire to share that knowledge.
It's a really beautiful thing because you can see it in people when they're like, you even again, like you find out some interesting fact about baseball and you know that you want to share that with someone, and you can see that enthusiasm, and it's a really beautiful thing.
My son, he's in a freshman this year, but last year in his eighth grade year, at the end of each grading trimester, his teacher gave the class the option to basically have a free day, but the catch was they had to learn something. So they figured out what's something that someone else in the class knows how to do that they can then teach other people in the class how to do.
Oh, wow.
So they had like people were like, I know how to play chess. I'll teach other people how to play chess. And the one that my son was telling me about, which he hated, was crocheting. So someone came in and was like, here,
it's a useful trade.
We're going to teach everyone how to crochet. And I just think that that's like, I was like, exactly there. That's it right there.
I feel like we all need to have a skill building day like that. Now I'm trying to think about what I would bring to people, you know?
Right. Well, and at the end of the day, that's actually what Rock Valley does with our community ed programs. Like if you scroll through the course directory for community ed, it's like knitting and sewing and Japanese, because somebody in the community knows how to do those things and is like, hey, I'll teach other people how to do that. And then the college facilitates that. And so it just,
That was a great segue, by the way. Yeah. That was a real professional segue.
Hey, there you go.
You mentioned about how when people ask you about why you wanted to become a teacher and, you know, the bank account snafu that eventually led you to be receiving the checks. But I am curious. I mean, we talk with a ton of people on the show who, you know, were teaching their siblings and stuffed animals and, like, playing class when they were 8 years old. And then plenty of people that had a completely different career and then eventually came back to it later on in life. For you, what did it kind of look like? Is teaching something that you kind of had an idea you might be interested in for a long time, or was it something that just kind of came to you later on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I always knew that I was going to be, that I tragically unmotivated by money. And so I always knew that the work that I did was going to be some kind of service, human service work. For a time, I wasn't sure if it was going to be law or social work or education. And, you know, it really did, it came down to, it's sort of cliche, but I had really positive experiences in English classes with English teachers that were like, hey, you're good at this. You know how to do this. You know how to not just put together sentences in ways that make sense, but also to look at texts and analyze them in thoughtful ways and to pull out from them what's there. And so I think I just was sort of, I was shepherded into that field because I had educators who encouraged me to do that. And so then I ended up in grad school. And then when you're in grad school, you get a graduate teaching assistant and then you get tossed in the classroom and you've never done it before. And you start thinking, okay, well, what worked for me? What didn't work for me? And then you just kind of kept doing it. And then eventually I was like, well, I guess this is it. You know, it sort of, I think the community college found me. I think that, you know, my intention was to get a PhD and then go work at some fancy place. As I was finishing my PhD, I got the job here. And at the time I was like, oh, this will just pay the bills until I get my quote unquote real job.
And was that in at the time that quote unquote real job, would that also be teaching or would it be something maybe completely different?
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking of like an R1, like a research one institution, being like,
sure,
the tweed jacket with the elbow patches, like, you know, Dead Poet Society.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
and then I got the job here and I just, it all kind of clicked in terms of recognizing that our students are the kinds of students that I find the most joy interacting with, in part because it's the stakes are so high, but the rewards are also really high for our students. You know, when I was going to some of the institutions that I studied at, it was just me and a bunch of other middle class and upper middle class kids. And so, you know, we could like navel gaze and read poetry and look at the stars.
Dead Poets Society.
Right.
Yeah.
But then to come to a place like Rock Valley, to a community college, and be like, seriously, what is the value of studying poetry for students that are like, I would just like to not be poor? And I think there is value in studying poetry when that's your objective in being in education. And so trying to figure that out, like, how do you communicate that in a way, I think was just such a challenge for me to recognize that I could translate or I could work on translating my special interests in the discipline that I'm motivated by and find a way to also then connect that to the kind of transformation that our students are looking for by coming here.
Is that something that clicked right away for you or
no.
Is that a process?
Oh, no. I was kind of a jackass, I think. Like, I think that I came in and my colleague, Mrs. Gilbert, who was on the hiring committee, she loves to tell this story where she's like, we were like, oh, who's this guy? Oh, yeah, no, he can do it. All right, fine. But we're going to have to shave off some of this ego. And I think that there was just a lot of recognizing, like, I think a lot of early educators, especially if you are coming into higher ed and you have not had extensive training on how to be an educator,
mm-hmm.
that you're just playing dress up. You're just being whatever version of the educator was that
right.
you had. And so, you know, I went to some pretty great institutions. And so I was just,
you were kind of cosplaying them.
I was cosplaying them. Exactly. And then, you know, quickly realizing that our students are just like, I don't know what this is. You know, like, I've never seen this show before.
You're like, he's doing a character.
Right, but
reason.
I don't know what it is.
He keeps wearing elbow pads.
Right.
I don't understand.
I don't get it. And so I think so much of being a strong educator is knowing yourself and shaving off all of that stuff that doesn't matter and getting to the point where you're like, my only job is to facilitate your learning and I am irrelevant in that equation, right? Like, what my interests are not as important as your learning. What I think is, you know, and then on top of that, what I've been saying for a handful of years is that we, especially coming out of COVID, I was like, we have to human first and then student second, right? We have to engage our students the same way that we would want to be engaged with as people, and then maybe we can build bridges to education. But I don't think that that came immediately to me because I was cosplaying.
Yeah, right. You know, you mentioned that, you know, you had some really great professors mm-hmm. and teachers in English, which is what initially,
yeah.
you know, brought you down that path. You know, one of the big things that we always ask in this show is about if you've had any educators in your life who've, you know, made a big impact on you. And again, that could be teachers that you had as a student. Mm-hmm. That could be colleagues that you work with right now.
Yeah.
When you think of it, who are kind of the, are there a few names that
absolutely.
Come to mind immediately?
Yeah. I mean, my high school English teacher, Mrs. Harvey, I think she's crazy as the day is long in the most perfectly wonderful ways. She had a tree in our classroom and she would talk to the fairies and the elves that lived in the tree.
Beautiful.
Every spring
yeah.
we would take a trip through the woods to see her favorite tree in the forest out behind the high school. Like, she was just nuts, but in the most wonderful possible way.
Yeah.
And she was
like
one
real,
of...
Like real, like, English teacher Miss Frizzle
yes,
vibe going
yes.
on. Yeah.
And I remember we had this in our final year of high school, we had this senior project basically where we had to do a protracted research project on a piece of literature, on a couple pieces of literature. And we really had like free rein to pick our own books, to like do whatever we wanted. There was constraints, but there was like there was a lot of freedom. And that was really the first time that I was able to explore the world through books, through literature, in a way that was like really self-directed, where I was like, oh, I can actually learn about places in the world and people and their experiences by deep diving into literature. I think, you know, so for me, I had that, I don't know if it was the same year or the year before, I had taken, so I grew up in Canada. So I took U.S. history as an elective in high school, which is really interesting because you know, obviously, I was in Canada. I wasn't not aware of the U.S. history, but yeah,
we demand a lot of attention, right. I think, no matter where you're at.
But, yeah. You know, in the history class, it was a year where we were like, okay, 1 year, start to finish, U.S. history, go. And...
Oh, we got some nice mood lighting.
Yeah, we got it. There we go.
Okay, there we go.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Thank you.
And so I got really fascinated by the U.S. Civil Rights Movement. At the same time, I was also taking a world religions class. And in the world religions class, I got really interested in Mahatma Gandhi and nonviolence. And so those two things kind of collided in those two classes. And I became kind of obsessed with Dr. King and the history of nonviolence and the philosophy of nonviolence. And so then I used that in the next year in my larger project with Mrs. Harvey, and I did a deep dive into the work of Toni Morrison. And I think like that was a moment that turned me toward the future that I'm now living.
I was going to say, it feels like you can draw a pretty direct path from that to, you know, the conversation we were having earlier on.
Precisely. And I think that was because my teachers had created the conditions where they had given me the tools, the frameworks, the information that I needed, as well as the freedom to explore it, and then showed me how, you know, the world, you can explore the entire world that way, that I can deep dive through, you know, I'm a white dude growing up in Canada, but I can, to the best of my ability, walk a couple miles in the shoes of the main character of Beloved, who tragically decides to end the life of her own child rather than let that child be taken back into slavery. And, you know, how else would I possibly even begin to think about what that might mean other than reading a book like that? And I think that these are those moments where education, literary education in particular, is this deep opportunity for people to practice how to be humans, where you can, you know, explore the experiences of others and practice empathy in those ways. So that's, I mean, absolutely straight line from Mrs. Harvey's English class to what I'm doing. It wasn't a straight line, but I can
say, it's in retrospect, it seems to be how life works a lot, that you don't see that in the moment. But then everything kind of makes a lot more sense thinking back on it.
Right. And I think the other piece, too, is it also that you're asking about other educators. Like, I think about the books that I've read as my teachers.
That was literally my next question is that, obviously those books and, you know, that can teach you a ton. And I was going to ask you the same question about books that you feel like you've learned a ton from.
And I think that's, you know, I'll go back to Toni Morrison, that I think that she's probably one of the most important teachers I've ever had, because she, in the book Beloved, if you haven't read it, everyone should read it, should be required reading, because it is just so awful. It is just so unthinkable. It is, oh my God, how could this mother kill her own daughter? But then you spend time with this individual and you learn about her motivations and you learn about the atrocities of her experience and you just spend time trying to think about what the world might be like. Okay, well, it's easy for me to say, oh, I would never do something like that, or that's a horrible thing to do. But I think this is one of the great strengths of someone like Toni Morrison, is that they take those very difficult, problematic scenarios and they slow them down for us and open them up as questions, right? That you don't have to have an answer to that question. You no one is, you know, Toni Morrison is not requiring you to weigh in on the morality of whether or not that mother did the right thing or not, right? That's not the point. The point is, can you slow down long enough that you can just look at that moment and be like, wow, that, huh? And like, and I think like that is such an important moment in my life to spend enough time with a text, with something, asking those questions and peeling back those layers of the onion until you get to that point where you're like, okay, I don't have an answer anymore, but I feel like I've found something. I don't know what, I don't know how to describe it, but I found something.
Right. Yeah. You know, actually that reminds me, I've been reading Ta-Nehisi Coates' new book, and something that book is really about writing, and he talks about reading, and he talks a lot about how literature and reading is so intimate, right? It's just you and your author alone, and that writing can really uncover some really sharp and often like really uncomfortable truths, and what a powerful thing that is. And that's such a, got to be some really interesting conversations with you and your class, and when you're considering every year about, you know, how much power these books wield, and how that's not something that we often think about.
100%. Absolutely. Yeah. I was teaching a poetry class last year, and we did a unit on banned books, because it was September, and we were doing banned books. And we read Ginsberg's Howl, and then we watched the film Howl, and we talked about, you know, obscenity laws, and how literally American obscenity laws to this day were generated because of a poem. And the rules around what is and is not obscene, what can and can't be said on TV, what can and cannot be put on the internet, what's illegal, what's legal, that's because of a poem. And to really think about how profound that is, that this text shaped American law in that way, is pretty remarkable. And I always think it's very interesting. And I had a student who read a couple lines of Howl and came to me and was like, I really feel very, very uncomfortable reading this. It's, she had some very closely held religious values that she felt like this was a stretch too far to be asked to read this text. And so she said, can I not read it? And I was like, we're literally in a unit about banned books, about the freedom to read, and the freedom to read includes the freedom not to read. You know, you're free to read it, or you're free not to read it. And I think these are the moments where, like, how else do people get the opportunity to think and talk about those kinds of things? Like, what does it really mean to be free? Really? And it became this little, like, miniature microcosm.
Who gets to make these decisions?
Who gets to make the decision, and who gets to prohibit that from you? And I'm like, it's not me. I'm not going to force you to read it, and I'm not going to force you not to read. Like, that's not on me. Like, education is an invitation. And so I just think that those are the moments, especially with literature, that become really fundamental and can shape people's experiences.
We've only got a couple more minutes I want to keep you for.
Sure.
So we can kind of, you know, rapid fire our way through the last couple that I'm really interested in. I know that you've taught a bunch of different classes, obviously just like composition classes. Mm-hmm. You've taught non-Western literature. You taught, I wrote it down because I wanted to make sure I had it on here. You taught the Bible as literature as well. Are there any courses, topics, subjects that you haven't taught yet that you would really, really love to teach?
Ooh, that's a great question. So here's one you probably didn't see, is I started I teach yoga as well.
I have
you
that got that. That, okay, was, you the did follow-up get, that question, was the follow-up question. Come on now.
So that was the one, that was the holdout. I was like, I got to find a way to teach yoga at the college level, which I did.
Yoga as mindfulness? Or
yoga for mindfulness, is the class, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's a great question. I think that we do not have, but I wish that we did have, an African American literature class. I would love to teach. I mean, I teach a lot of African American literature in the classes that I teach just anyway, but I would love to have a class that was just African American lit.
I have to ask again, Gabba, about you teaching the yoga class that you got the opportunity to do. Did that give you a different kind of satisfaction than your other type of classroom teaching?
Absolutely. But both have been deeply influenced by the other. I think that a lot of the work that I've done, like anti-racist work, decolonial work, as an educator, just immediately transfers over to the teaching of yoga, which is, you know, wildly colonialized by the West, and trying to like figure out how to do that respectfully and thoughtfully. And I think there's something about that too, where you're like, how do I talk about these traditions in a way that is thoughtful and respectful while also recognizing my own position, which is, you know, it's a very literary way of thinking right. about something. Yeah. But I think the benefit of it, the other piece of it, is that we often talk in literature about like lived experience, embodied experiences, but we're talking about embodied experiences in the abstract through the text, where in a yoga class, you really are
very physically.
It is the embodiment of the teaching. And I think that's a really interesting little nugget to chew on.
So we talked about the teacher that you had growing up that, mm-hmm. you know, had their favorite tree they would mm-hmm. take you out to.
Yep.
I'm someone that loves to read outdoors and find really like, you know, peaceful places mm-hmm. to read and stuff. I was curious for you, do you have any favorite places? Could be outdoors, could be indoors also, but just favorite places to read or write?
In my bed.
Always a good call.
or outside with a fire.
Outside with a fire. That's a good call.
Yep.
Book that you've recommended to the most people?
Ooh. Probably there's two. Toni Morrison's Beloved, which I already talked about. And then Colson Whitehead's The Nickel Boys.
I haven't read it.
You should immediately. Yeah. I read a lot of books, and it was the first book in probably like 10 or 15 years that I won't give anything away other than to say there is a twist at the end that I did not see coming and was an absolute gut punch. And I love that book because it reminded me what it felt like to be punched in the gut by a book.
That's great. It's going on the list. Hopefully it's other people that are listening to are going to as well. And I have to love going along those same lines. You mentioned that you read all the time.
Mm-hmm.
What are the tensions though? You know, we talked about you wearing 11 different hats and the mm-hmm. different roles and projects and yeah. research that you're working on, is that sometimes that means that you don't have as much time mm-hmm. to read for pleasure on top of just like,
yeah.
you know, you have to cook and you have to, you know, you're right. spending time with your family, you're living life, right? Do you still have time to read for pleasure?
Yeah, I do. So after I finished, while I was finishing my PhD, and then for about 2 or 3 years after I finished my PhD, I don't think I read a single thing that I didn't have to read, because I was just exhausted and I just couldn't.
Right.
I had lost the pleasure. And then over the last 5, 6, 7 years, I've like kind of decided, I was like, this is important to me. I want to do this. And so I kind of just found my way back into it. And the way I found my way back into it was just taking off all guardrails and just say, like, number one, if I start a book and I don't like it, I don't finish it. Immediately I put it down because I don't know.
Some costs.
Just cut ties and move on. Maybe I'll come back to it later. Maybe I won't. And to just read whatever catches my interest. And sometimes that's a book of poetry. Sometimes that's like right now I'm reading a dragon fantasy book because it's just fun
yeah.
and I'm enjoying it. You know, and sometimes I'll double back and I'll find a classic that I haven't read and I'll reread it or read it for the first time. And so I am not one of those English teachers that's like, you must only read the important things. I think you should read whatever you want. Whatever.
And that is important, right?
Yeah.
Who gets to decide what's important? Right?
Precisely. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I have 3 kids and they all have vastly different reading tastes. And I'm right. like, great, good. Read more. Do you want to go to the library again? You know?
You know, it's interesting talking about, I think it's a great point where you mentioned about cutting ties with books that, you yeah. know, you're not vibing with, just letting it go. Maybe you'll come back to it. Maybe you won't. Because I definitely have an instinct, and I always have to push back against it. I know other people do, where you start reading a book, you set it down. Maybe it's not even that you hate it. It's just, you know, for whatever reason, you're not in the mood. And then you put it on the nightstand next to your bed, and then you've got 2 books, and you've got 3 books, and then you're just staring at, like, a small stack
right.
of things that you're 50 to 100 pages in, and you're like, God, I'm the worst.
Right.
But, like, just let it go. Just move on.
Let it go. And so whenever I visit my dad, I always laugh because I go to his bookshelf and he never has by his bookmarks. And even if he does, he doesn't use them. And everything is just a little slice of paper. And so you look on his bookshelf and every book has the little bookmark. And it's like, it's never finished. It's always somewhere in the middle. Someone once told me their rule was that you start at 100 and you subtract your age. And that's how many pages of a book you should read before you give up on it. So if you're like a new reader, you should read more. But once you're like in your 60s, you only have to read 40 pages.
Right. Then and you if you're 100, you look at the cover,
you just
cares?
Decide.
Get
right,
out.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that's an interesting rule of thumb. But again, I'm like, I don't know. Sometimes I don't know. The cover will do it for me. Sometimes.
I think we're coming back to the main theme. You have the freedom. Do whatever
exactly.
you want.
Right.
Read it, don't read it.
Right.
But just make sure you're reading
just
something.
Just read something.
Last two questions we always ask are kind of similar to each other, but we'll go one more specific, one a little bit more broad. Something about teaching or learning English in particular that you wish more people knew?
That my job is not about teaching people grammar.
I do love an M-dash, though.
Sure, yeah. A good semicolon. I do like teaching people what a semicolon is, because it's literally what it is. It's a period and a comma.
Regular colon.
It is what it is. Yeah. I wish that people knew that I wasn't just teaching grammar because that's not what I do.
And then just generally something about teaching you wish more people knew.
I think this is kind of well known, but I mean, it really is exhausting. Yeah. I have said to a colleague of mine, you know, an hour in the classroom is like 2 to 3 hours in real life. Like it is exhausting.
It's very Broadway. It really is.
You're
eight
right.
Shows a week.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it's taxing mentally and emotionally in a way that other kinds of labor aren't. The other kinds of labor are taxing in their own ways. But it's not necessarily an easy gig.
Yeah. I think you'll appreciate there's a metaphor that we come to on the show a lot is that, especially when they would be like, oh, you guys get the summers off. You know, you've gotten that a million times, right? But I always, the joke that we always make is that it's like a musician going on tour.
Right.
Where it's just like, yeah, no, we're doing shows every night and we're traveling the world for 9 months. And so you're kind of just like, I'm barely there during the school year. And then you kind of return home from tour in the summer.
Right. Yeah. I like that. That's a good metaphor. I might use that one again.
There you go. Well, that was all I had for you.
Awesome. Matthew,
I'm so glad that we got to make this happen, and thank you for the stickers.
You're welcome.
And then the buttons. I'm going to be wearing it right next to my I voted sticker in a couple days here.
Awesome.
Great. Great, man. Thanks
thank
so
you.
Much. That was Rock Valley College English professor Matthew Oakes. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be featured on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests like Matthew. You could send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And wherever you're hearing the podcast, please do subscribe, leave us a rating, or share it. If you like what we do, it really is the best way to help us get even more perspectives on the show. You can subscribe to the Teacher's Lounge newsletter if you really want to keep up to date with everything we've got going on with our show. You can find a link to do that on this episode's webpage over at WNIJ.org. And a big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of our show. A big thank you to Spencer Tritt for making our Teacher's Lounge logo you might be looking at right now. And I've been your host, Peter Mudlin, and we'll be back with more Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.